Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan.
There is an organization, a government organization, called the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which promotes museums and libraries. And Cindy Landrum is the deputy director of the Office of Library Services. We know the importance of visiting museums and libraries. What I notice, though, is that museums and libraries are being challenged these days when they attempt to present the more challenging aspects of American history. What's the guidance on that? What do people have a right to expect of their museums and libraries?
Well, museums and libraries in general are community-based organizations and representative of all members of the community. And at the Institute of Museum and Library Services, of course, we respect local control of those decisions, but we also recognize that decision-making should occur with a sense of equality and with a focus on access and literacy for all members of the community.
So what is the director of a library, what's their job if they get a challenge from him? Like we saw at this school in Florida where a parent said that the inaugural poem that was read at Barack Obama's inauguration was including, indirect hate messages. How do you handle things like that?
Well, most libraries do have a particular process. First of all, challenges to material and information have existed since the beginning of time, since information has existed, if you will. And most libraries have a process that does permit individuals to present a formal challenge and a process that does that. And most library directors, along with their trustees or governing bodies, will follow that formal process.
So what's the future of libraries in an era of, digital media and chatbots?
Well, I think libraries have a very unique position and role to play in technology. And as you know, with the inception of the internet, there was this similar question emerged and continues to emerge. But as we've seen, libraries have continued to iterate and adapt to those challenges. We know that there are still digital divides in our country, and libraries have really stepped in to fill those divides, both in terms of providing access to technologies, but also assisting with digital literacy and skill building and helping people to skill up as we see technology changing in terms of our work and learning environments.
And you're not concerned that there is a growing trend of people attempting to censor information that makes them feel uncomfortable?
Even though we know that particularly at this time, there has been an increase in challenges to information, this is not new. And as you can imagine, libraries have continued to strive and thrive despite some of the many challenges, whether those challenges are similar to the ones we are seeing now, or as you mentioned before, challenges around funding and things of that nature.
Cindy Landrum is the Deputy Director of the Office of Library Services. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to Bacton's Quality Roofing. It's time to get Chris's tips for the Memorial Day weekend. So what is the latest on where you can park and all the rest of that stuff?
Well, there's one thing I want to go over. By the way, they're expecting, 164,000 people at the airport today, 171,000 tomorrow.
Yeah.
We're back to 2019, almost pre-pandemic Memorial Day weekends. But something I wanted to tell everybody about, because getting to the airport's stressful enough. I know there are a bunch of people waiting in line now because the arrivals deck is closed for construction. I had someone ask me recently, is like, why do they allow people to park along the side of the expressway while they're waiting for people to come to the airport. You see it all the time, right? And the question is, you know, why do people do that? And it's something that I've never understood. I mean, there are giant signs there on the side of the road that say, you cannot park here.
And there's a cell phone lot, isn't there?
No, there's a great cell phone lot. It's brand new construction on it. Makes it a lot easier to get in there, and it's only a quarter mile away. And the thing is that you can sit on that shoulder, which is illegal, and you can endanger your life and the lives of others. I talked to a Port of Seattle Police Sergeant Daniel Breed yesterday about what he sees out there, the behavior of this, and he says it's just not worth the risk to sit on the shoulder.
Parking on the shoulder is very dangerous. Somebody pulls out, they could get rear-ended. I mean, it's happened. Everybody knows on the freeways, people get rear-ended on the shoulders even of the freeways. So it's very dangerous to park there.
Now, I can hear you thinking, oh, I'm only there for a couple of minutes. What's the big deal? Well, it's selfish and it's not safe. It makes a stressful situation for everybody much worse. Sergeant Breed says you're also staring down a $50 fine if the officers want to cite you.
We obviously do enforcement out there, number one. So we will ticket people out there. However, when I have gone out there, they say, hey, like, I'm confused, I don't understand. Even though the sign says no parking, there's still a little confusion. They say, I thought this was the cell phone parking lot.
Oh, really?
Come on.
Yeah, nobody's buying that, really? I mean, come on.
Well, maybe what you have to do is put up signs and say, this is not the cell phone lot.
Parking is not good enough?
No, apparently not.
Yeah, and even yesterday, there was a line of like 10 or 11 cars there sitting there. And, you know, the shoulder is not a cell phone lot. And there's a giant blue sign that says cell phone lot next left. So why do people do this? Sergeant Breed believes it's because travelers have a skewed view of time, the time it takes their people to get off the plane and get to the curb outside the terminal.
When people get off the airplane and say, I've arrived, and so the person picking up the person says, I got to get there immediately to pick this person up. Arriving is different than actually arriving on the drive. There's still a 20 to 30 minute window when you get out to the shoulder of...
Exactly.
So there, it's a skewed sense of time.
As a long-time cell phone lot user.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get the text message, where wheels down, and then you set the clock for 20 minutes.
Yeah, at least. And he goes, and that's his advice as well. Just sit there at the cell phone lot, not on the shoulder, and then wait for the person to tell you that they are actually on the curb and there, and then go.
So when it gets really bad where you see a complete line of cars, that's probably when we'll more likely do enforcement. And we don't like doing enforcement. We don't like giving people tickets, but it's kind of the only way we can drive home our point of this is a dangerous situation. We need people not to park here.
Now, if you want another option, here is Sergeant Breed's top secret move. This is the one that he uses when picking people up at the airport and not working. And he's been working at SEA for 18 years. He says use the parking garage, not to park, but to meet your people. You get 10 minutes in the garage before you have to pay.
If you can arrange it properly and have your party go into the garage, be waiting for you, you pull in, pick them up, and pull out, there's no charge for using that.
So you get 7 minutes?
Yeah.
We had discussed 7 minutes. It turns out it's actually 10. Mm-hmm. And even if you take 11 minutes and you get charged for the hour, that's only $8, much better than a $50 fine for sitting on the side of the expressway illegally. Yeah. Of course, that $50 fine also applies if you're parking at the terminal waiting too long for your people to arrive. So let's think of it this way. Would you park on the side of a freeway and pull out a book? Of course you wouldn't. So why would you do it on the expressway to the airport? Mm. Let's stop this, please.
Yeah. I know what they could do. They could put up a sign on the expressway there saying, emergency lane parking, $100.
Then you can
and then just charge people.
Yeah, I mean, but no, I mean, we got to get. And what's interesting is lately I've also seen people doing it further down toward the arrivals and departures deck, off on the shoulder there too. I'm like, I just don't understand when there's a cell phone lot that has a ton of capacity.
But it's like, you know, three turns to get there, so people are lazy.
Yeah. Well, again, you shouldn't do it. It's dangerous for you and for others. So just think about that today. I know it's a pain to get in there right now until they open that arrivals deck, but yeah, just don't do this. It's not necessary.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. Stuart Rhodes is being sentenced today. Let's go to CBS News congressional correspondent Scott McFarland. Remind us what Stuart Rhodes' role in the January 6th attack was, Scott.
He, He was convicted of being a plotter and a planner, somebody who came to Washington, D.C. that day and that week with a plan to block the peaceful transfer of power. And Rhodes, uniquely, was accused of this plan to stage guns outside the Washington, D.C. city limits in case Trump invoked the Insurrection Act. This is the highest level U.S. Capitol riot prosecution far and away so far. And this sentencing is so important because this is really a first modern-day sentencing for sedition against America. This is going to be history no matter what.
Yeah. The idea that the guns were being stored, this was at, as I recall, a hotel somewhere, and they were thinking even of bringing them across the Potomac in boats or something?
That's right. They were in Virginia, across the river, and there was a plan that they may need to use, boats to taxi the guns into the city. It's part and parcel of an argument the Department of Justice made that this group was ready for battle. They weren't just here to peacefully protest or be part of a crowd. They were here ready for the potential of violence. And this lays down a marker for future cases because others have since been convicted of seditious conspiracy, including members of the far-right Proud Boys, including one from the Seattle area. And these cases are all coming later this summer. So what happens to Stuart Rhodes today lays down a marker and a foundation for those other defendants that are happening later this year.
Right. And he was not part of the actual physical attack himself then, right?
He was not inside the Capitol. That was a component, by the way, of his defense at trial, that he never went in. I suspect he'll make references to that today when he asks for leniency. But other oath keepers did go in, and others who were co-defendants were very much inside.
Right. Wasn't he saying, because a lot of this was based on text messages and such, he was arguing that, don't pay attention to that, I was just blowing off steam?
He, like many January 6th defendants, have argued that there was a difference between their political rhetoric and what actually happened that day, that they talked a big game but didn't do a whole lot. The Oath Keepers argued they didn't attack police, they didn't beat anybody, they didn't use chemical spray in the face of police officers. But a jury here in Washington, D.C. was unequivocal in their message. They came back with guilty verdicts for seditious conspiracy. They believe Stuart Rhodes, at least one of his co-defendants, were truly conspiring against America. And it's interesting to say it out loud, Dave, because there's not a whole lot of parallels to this. Guilty of conspiring to block the peaceful transfer of power in America. That's what underwrites today's sentencing hearing with such importance. The Department of Justice is going to seek a quarter century in prison for that type of crime. Rhodes is going to ask for time served, be sent home. That's a pretty big difference. We'll see where the judge comes down.
So he could face 25 years?
Yes, and that's a really critical, Dave, because there are other seditious conspiracy defendants still to come. And if the judge comes close to 25 years in his sentence, what a precedent that sets for the other cases coming down the road.
CBS correspondent Scott McFarland. Scott, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's get an update on Ukraine with CBS News military consultant Jeff McCausland. I see, among other things, that Russia is now claiming it apparently has evidence that Ukraine was, in fact, behind those drone attacks earlier this month on Moscow.
That's what they claim, Dave. Obviously, this has to be taken with a great grain of salt. It's possible it could have been Ukrainians. It could have been Ukrainians supported by the government. I find that a little bit hard to believe because the nature of this attack was certainly not going to be one that was going to be dramatically successful, certainly embarrassing. Mr. Putin was not in the Kremlin. I think there's still some reason to believe it was people internal to Russia. And if so, obviously the Kremlin would want to blame Ukraine and not acknowledge some type of opposition within the country. And I still think the possibility that the Russians orchestrated itself in an effort to try to unify the country in advance of Victory Day, rally around the flag, if you will, and give them reason to reduce the level of the Victory Day parade, which they certainly did.
Yeah. All right. So what's the situation on the ground as of today, Jeff?
Well, what's going on, Dave, I think, is shaping operations. That's been going on for quite some period of time, informationally, diplomatically, as well as militarily on the ground. Diplomatically, of course, in the last week, we saw this dramatic trip by Mr. Zelensky going to Europe to all the major capitals, meeting all the major leaders, including the Pope. Then he goes and meets with the Arab League and pleads for their support, a group that's been kind of sitting on the fence. And then he shows up at the G7 rather dramatically in Tokyo to meet all the Western leaders once again, as well as people like President Biden, of course, and Prime Minister Modi, who was there as a guest of the G7, once again to make the case for Ukraine and receive the announcement that the United States would support the training and eventually the transfer of F-16 fighters. So he's building up international support around the world. And then on the ground, of course, we've seen, I think, shaping operations going on around Bakhmut as they've expanded the shoulders of that particular area. They've lost some ground. The Russians claim they've captured Bakhmut, but at this point, Bakhmut at best for the Russians is a Pyrrhic victory, having lost thousands and thousands of troops, and it has really no significant strategic value. And now the Ukrainians are bolstering the last of their forces to prepare for this long-heralded counteroffensive, which I expect to occur in the next few days.
And so what will that counteroffensive look like? What territory do they aim to take here?
Well, it's still unclear, and I'm sure one of the things they've been doing is reconnaissance of Russian defenses along that 600-mile front to determine where they might achieve a breakthrough, because what they want is a breakthrough and then try to move armored and mechanized forces through that breakthrough to, if you will, envelop it and collapse the entire front. That would be the best of all possible worlds. My guess is they need to have some kind of a success which is strategic as opposed to operationally tactical. Really show the West that we can be successful overall, though I don't think this offensive necessarily would be absolutely decisive. Really embarrass the Russians. And that would be something like splitting that land bridge that connects Russia proper right now with Crimea, isolating Crimea, taking back a substantial piece of territory, perhaps even being able to succeed in recapturing a major city like Melitopol would be a classic example, because it's also a nexus of a lot of rail networks and highway networks down there in the southern part of Ukraine.
But given that they've been telegraphing this offensive for many months now, I mean, we all know about it. Wouldn't Russia be completely prepared to turn this back?
Well, we think so, but the Russians have been in such disarray in terms of what we call force generation, and that means resupplying forces, training forces, and replacing lost equipment, and that I'm not sure they can respond to it. And don't forget, the Russians have got to be successful along a 600-mile front, but the Ukrainians have to be successful in a pretty narrow portion of that front that might crack those particular defenses. So that gives them certain advantages. And at the same time, I think really for more political narrative reasons, the Russians have continued to pour more and more troops into Bakhmut, which has been really a meat grinder in many, many ways. But obviously that has denuded other parts of the area, but they have not been able to position forces. And finally, I think that's part of the reason why they've heard about these raids in Belgorod and other areas of Russia proper in that same region over the last few days. I think these are efforts by Ukrainians or people supporting the Ukrainians to get the Russians to reposition forces in an effort to thin the defensive lines at certain places and allow that offensive to be successful.
CBS News military analyst Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. Actress Cheryl Lee Ralph plays Mrs. Barbara Howard on the Emmy-winning show Abbott Elementary.
This work is a desk for you student, Mrs. Howard.
Mr. Johnson, that is a dining table from the cafeteria, and you are a fool.
Ralph is speaking up for teachers and describing what experiencing kindness from a white teacher meant to her during the early days of desegregation. Ralph tells ABC's Good Morning America.
You know, it just makes me feel so good that we can shine a good light on some of the most important people in our lives. Teachers. Educators.
Ralph's primary school education came at a time when racial tensions were high across the country and the push for desegregation in public schools was still a hotly contested practice. The actress at that time was only 2 years younger than 6-year-old Ruby Bridges, the first black student to attend an all-white school in 1960. She says she still feels her teacher's hand intertwined with hers all these years later. Ralph works to portray the same qualities that Ms. Spencer demonstrated to her, kindness, patience, and understanding in her role as Barbara Howard in Abbott Elementary.
You have got to believe in yourself in your lowest moments. You've got to be able to look up, look in the mirror, and love what you see. You've got to be able to give yourself hope. You must be your own greatest cheerleader. You've got to be able to hug yourself and say, I love you. I understand. It will be all right. You will smile again. You have to do that for yourself. Speak truth to your own personal power. We get so lost into carrying all the luggage of the past, doubt, of disrespect, what other people think of us.
Yeah.
You got to put that luggage down sometime. Free yourself up to lighten yourself up. To give yourself hope.
Actress Cheryl Lee Ralph in Abbott Elementary. Actually a very fun show to watch. If you've never seen it, give it a shot.
7:48 and now from the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9. Here's G. Scott.
Sad.
Another NFL rule change.
Love it.
So tell me about the kickoff here.
So the receiving team on kickoff, so when the opposing team gets ready to kick it off to the other team, the receiving team now can fair catch it and just have the ball placed so the player would be back there. They call for a fair catch. The fair catch was signaled that, hey, they're going to be placing the ball at the 25. So instead of it being maybe a touchback or kicked off and goes out into the back of the end zone, if it's short of that and they catch the ball, they can just wave their hand in the air and they can signal for the fair catch and then they can move the ball up right there to the 25. Whereas before, if they were to catch it right there, it would and just kind of call a fair catch or kneel the ball right there, then what would happen is they would spot it right there. So this is an opportunity to clean a game up, have less injury.
Andy Reid, more run backs?
You can, but if you choose not to, right? Like you could choose not to. You can. So if they kick it off and you don't fair catch it, you can run it back. Look, the NFL. This is why the NFL is king. And we all complain. A lot of people complain. Oh, this football stuff is getting soft. It's getting soft. Go down there on the field and you tell me if the NFL is soft. I can assure you that these players are not soft. I can assure you that they are bigger, stronger, and faster than ever before. Yes.
So, question, why is it more dangerous to place the ball where it's caught, if it's caught closer to the end zone versus 25 feet? Why is that resulting in more injuries?
Well, what's resulting in injuries is the whole kickoff thing, right? And these guys are going down and trying to block. And before they used to be able to get running starts to go down there, these are big guys going at each other for really most kickoff returns don't really amount to much anyways. Do I believe that this is the future? Meaning, like, at some point, are they going to do away with kickoffs? And kick off? Yes.
Really?
I do. I 100% do. Right now, did you guys know the average NFL career is 2.8 years? Right? There's a lot of injury, a lot of turnover. It is a very dangerous sport. You can't 1 minute care and say you care about safety and not do the things that matter. And I think the reason why the NFL is king is because they have continued, especially over the last 15 years, of really making this game different. Go look on YouTube and look at the games in the 80s and the 90s. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
They allowed a lot of stuff that they don't today, which is really a good thing. Now, I know the game is three phases, offense, defense, and special teams. Don't want to take away the special teams. You know, there's field goal, there's punt, there's all aspects. But that specific portion of the game, the actual kickoff, I think they can do away with that.
So how does it start in the future without the kickoff?
They just drop the football in the scrimmage.
That's what I think is eventually going to happen.
Ball.
It's not there yet, right? But I do eventually think the future, maybe 5-10 years from now, it will be, all right, Dave Ross, your team's ball, place the ball at the 25, just, place the ball at the 25.
Just start there. Like,
yeah.
Just curious, though, how we ultimately make this a safer game, because as we know from brain injuries, from studies, that this is really inherently dangerous when you're banging your heads around. Like you said, they're big physical guys. We really can't make this 100% safe, can we?
Do it, no, you can't. But doing this helps, right? Doing this here matters.
Step
by step. And the NFL is doing a good job. There's a lot of, like, baseball. I don't want to get into the whole baseball thing, but for years, baseball never wanted to change. Like, oh, this is just the way you do it. It's America's pastime. No, it ain't. No, it's not. Baseball is not America's pastime anymore. Past something else. Not everybody's
but
entertainment.
But it's changed over the years, too. Baseball certainly
just
has.
Recently, right?
In the past.
But the pitch clock, that kind of helps. The wider bases kind of helps. But those little things that I'm glad baseball is doing, this is what NFL has been doing for the last 15
because
years.
Football is a struggle for territory. I mean, it's fundamentally different than any other sport, right? It's that you're struggling to gain ground and keep it. It's like war.
It is, but it's captured all of our attention. Remember back in the day, in the 80s, 70s, 80s, the heavyweight champion was probably the most known person in the United States.
Yep.
You ready for this? If you're listening, who's the heavyweight champion right now?
I have no idea.
Egg bingo. See you guys.
G Scott, 9 o'clock with Ursula Roy Teen. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.